Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The time for arguing is over, according to my guest today. Climate change, they say, is not only real, it's already with us. But rather than apportioning blame, they argue we should actually seize the opportunity to radically reinvent ourselves. As part of our Environmental Outlook series, we look at how we as individuals and communities could triumph over the threat of climate change. Amy Seidel is an ecologist. She's the author of a book titled Finding Higher Ground. Michael McCracken is chief scientist at the Climate Institute. And joining us by ISDN from Sydney is Paul Gilding. He's an environmentalist and author of The Great Disruption. I look forward to hearing your calls, comments, questions throughout the hour. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. I'll start with you, Mike McCracken. There have certainly been dire predictions about what's happening now. Give us a sense of your assessment of where we are now in regard to climate change.
Well, what we're having happen is emissions are continuing to go up, atmospheric composition is changing, we're having a greater warming influence, the temperatures of the world are going up, heat index is going up, sea levels going up, sea ice and glacial ice is melting and thawing back. We're having more frequent and greater likelihood of extreme events and a higher risk. So lots of things are going up. All of those are very sort of unfortunate changes that are happening in that regard.
What's happened in Greenland and Antarctica?
Well, in Greenland, as it's sort of a block of ice, and as the temperature has increased on the edges, you're getting a lot of thawing of ice around the edges. Greenland's been here for 10,000 years sort of as it is, and it's starting to lose mass rather dramatically. And that's very worrisome. That's also happening on parts of the Antarctic Peninsula and West Antarctica. Greenland's important because it has enough ice and water tied up on land that it, if it were all to melt, could raise sea levels by about 20 feet. And the projection is that if we keep going at sort of the accelerating rate we're headed at, that sea level rise this century might be a few feet. So that's a tremendous amount
of change.
All right.
Well, given that sort of outlook, what would you expect this planet to look like, say, 50 years from now? Based on what we know now?
Well, the projections are that in some sense the northern tier of states will have climatic conditions of toward what the middle of the country is, sort of in the latter part, as we head toward the latter part of the century.
What does that mean?
The central tier. Well, so if you were in if you're in Boston, you're going to start getting the climate more like what's in Washington. Now, for people, that isn't perhaps quite so bad. You can figure out how to adapt because you're inside a building. But for the environment and what's going on outside, that is a tremendous change. As you have sea level going up in some of the areas, going up in Chesapeake Bay and where there's very flat land, or in southern Florida where there's flat land, or in New Orleans or Bangladesh or a whole host of places, you're going to have the sort of a higher sea level, and the worrisome time is when the storms come. If hurricanes tend to become more powerful, they push a bigger storm surge onto land, and it'll be higher because of what's happening, because of the water we're adding to the ocean.
Mike McCracken. He's chief scientist for climate change programs at the Climate Institute. Paul Gilding, in your book, you suggest that indeed a catastrophic collapse of our way of life is in some ways unavoidable. How do you come to that conclusion?
I think we have to recognize that we're currently operating the system, the Earth system, the global economy, at the edge of its capacity. So in terms of food production, in terms of oil use, there isn't a lot of room for dramatic change. And what Mike and many other scientists are saying is we're going to face dramatic change. Now, what that change looks like for us, I think, is economic. We are going to see, I think, the end of economic growth as we know it, the idea that we can all live with a consumer lifestyle and have more and more stuff as the basis of our happiness and our potential as human beings is basically not physically possible anymore. And the climate change is simply the kind of the hard edge, the sharp end of that issue. But we have a whole range of resource constraints from water to available soil and so on, which I think is going to lead to the potential for a major collapse of civilization. But the good news in this to me is therefore we're going to respond. Therefore, we're going to have a reaction which is probably more akin to kind of a warlike mobilization than anything we currently imagine in this area. And what we see from history, World War II and other examples, is that we're very good in a crisis. Mm. So we can lament that and say, well, that's silly, we should have acted earlier. It is silly. We should have acted earlier, but we didn't. And now we're at the time when the climate is changing, when we are going to face those limits, and therefore we are going to see dramatic shifts in humanity. And that's the great opportunity, I think, in this space.
Are you saying, Paul, that you think the collapse, if you will, is already underway?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that what we're seeing in many ways, even with the debt crisis in the US in recent weeks, is really about, you know, we can't get this economy to grow anymore because there's a range of physical limits to that growth, which translate into many, you know, commodity prices, oil prices, food prices and so on. But as we get the economy growing again, we hit those limits again and we have problems getting the economy to move, and so we borrow more money and we pile more money into the system to try and get it moving again, and we're now facing, I think, the end of growth, and that crisis is now definitely upon us. It's not a sudden thing happens on a certain day, but it's not over decades. Mm. We're talking, I think, this decade now that we're seeing this unfold, and climate is in many ways just one of the examples of those limits being breached.
Paul Gilding, he's climate change advisor and author of The Great Disruption, Why the Climate Crisis Will Bring an End of Shopping and the Birth of a New World. And turning to you, Amy Seidel, do you agree, have we passed a point of no return as far as climate is concerned?
I think there are lots and lots of indicators that we have reached ecological and planetary constraints. But what I also think is that these tough circumstances need to be addressed with vision and leadership. And so what I have set to do is to take a very pragmatic approach to what that leadership and vision might be. And I've illustrated with a narrative individuals who see these changes upon them in the places where they live, see the conditions changing, and have decided to rise to that capacity and try to not only predict those changes, but to marry them to new infrastructure, new design.
Give
that will
me
be
an
successful.
Example.
Well, there in the book, Finding Higher Ground, I talk about energy, food systems, building systems. But in food systems, for instance, this year we had such record rain in the Northeast, you know, the months of April and May, historic rain on record. We couldn't get corn planted in the Northeast, much like the Midwest, 5 and 6 times of planting. Others have been thinking about rice. If you can grow rice in an area that has greater deluge events, which is a prediction of climate change in the Northeast, and 30% more precipitation by 2050, perhaps other kinds of grains and nutrient-rich products like rice is a better idea than corn.
So you give up what you've been growing for years and years and years. you turn to other products.
That's right. Just as we're seeing in biological communities, those communities are responding evolutionarily to climate change. We, too, will respond through our culture, but as an evolutionary response to climate change.
Amy Seitel is the author of a book titled Finding Higher Ground, Adaptation in the Age of Warming. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Mike McCracken, if we were to cease carbon dioxide emissions today and sort of rein in the harmful chemicals that are loaded into the atmosphere, would we be able at this point to avoid the kind of scenario that we're not only seeing in the future, but perhaps experiencing in the present?
Well, if we could end all emissions tomorrow, we could actually, we would recover to some extent. The world would recover. But fossil fuels provide over 80% of the world's energy. And with 7 billion people in the world, you can't sustain them without using fossil fuels. So it's going to have to be a transition over time that occurs. The question is how fast we can accomplish that. If we can do that, if we can work hard to do that over the next few decades, then that will be, we'll have a good chance. If not, we're going to have very large consequences.
Mike McCracken, chief scientist for Climate Change Programs at the Climate Institute. Short break, right back. And we're talking about climate change, what can be done, as with many, many scientists now agree, this is our future. But the question is, what can we as individuals and as communities do not only to face into climate change, but to adapt somehow to it? And we've gotten lots of messages already on email and Facebook. One says, I fear for both the U.S. and the world more than ever. There will not be the leadership required to steer the world from coming calamities. As we've just witnessed, we elect those whose priorities and reasons for running for elected office may not be the same as ours. It would seem, Amy, that an awful lot of people feel that leadership is lacking in the kinds of things you are talking about.
That's absolutely right. And if we look at the mitigative successes in this country, they've not come from a federal regulatory pressure. They've come because individual cities and towns and states have seen the writing on the wall and begun to become less vulnerable and to increase their ability to mitigate, to reduce their carbon. I think that not only is leadership lacking, but it's important to look for where the grassroots is beginning to percolate up to actually show how this capacity can be built. Now, I'm entirely sanguine about this. I want to be clear that mitigative pressure is paramount here and essential. And yet we're also very apparent to us, these heat waves, these flooding events, what we saw in Pakistan and Russia last summer. And in this country this summer, the phenomenon are upon us. So we have to simultaneously press for mitigative effort and hope for a federal approach there while we build from the grassroots as well as adapt in our communities.
But now, Mike McCracken, there's been lots of talk about geo or climate engineering. How possible is that or could that be to mitigate what seems to be happening?
Well, the notion is that if we can cause climate change when we don't intend to, maybe we can do something by intending to do that to try and counterbalance it. It's all pretty speculative right now. There are some ideas. Basically, one might try and imitate what a volcano does, which our experience is that a large volcano will cool the climate a little bit. So you might put a lot of sulfate aerosol up in the stratosphere, and that would reflect some solar radiation away. That has other side effects. There's no such thing as a free lunch here. And it has some real limits about what you can do. I mean, volcanoes, when we had Pinatubo or something, reduced the temperature by fractions of a degree. And we're talking about degrees of change. And so you'd have to do a Pinatubo or something every year or two kind of event. And that has a number of side effects. So, I mean, the scientific community is sort of getting so concerned that so little is happening with mitigation that we're looking and exploring other possible kinds of things to do. And there may be some that can be done for some parts of the problem. But it really only makes sense if we really make a strong effort to reduce our emissions as rapidly as we can and then sort of shave off the peak of the temperature and climate change, hoping that we can get it back under control and not pass that on as a responsibility to future generations.
And Paul Gilding, of course, we've heard about all these, doomsday scenarios. There's also those, including yourself, who believe that disruption from climate change, as you call it, could actually be a good thing. How come?
Yeah, look, because I think humans are really bad when things are going well and really good in a crisis. And I think that it's sort of sad but true that we should have acted on climate change decades ago, and certainly a decade ago. We're still not acting really globally yet. And therefore, when the crisis comes, we will get our act together and we will do amazing things. And people are incredibly capable, as Amy's seeing at the local level, of changing when our backs are up against the wall. And therefore, I think the changes that we need to make, I mean, big changes. We're talking about really virtually eliminating the coal industry around the world. We're talking about inventing whole new industries, which fortunately, by the way, are much more job intensive and bring a whole lot of other benefits as well. But we have to go through this massive economic transformation. And what we know from history is that in a crisis, we're good at doing that. We're not good at doing it preemptively. We're not good at doing it because we think the risk analysis justifies it, but we are good, as we have been in, for example, I think World War II is still the best example. Mm. You know, when we need to, we can do it, and we do remarkable things, and then leadership emerges. Leadership emerges at the local level, but also at the national and global level, and then we start to see those big changes happening. And then in this case, the changes are about having better energy security, about having less imports of oil, about having cleaner cities, about having a whole range of more local jobs and more creation of local economic activity, all of which are actually good for our society across the board.
good for society across the board. And yet, I mean, we've had examples. Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, for example. Hurricane Katrina has still left a great many people without housing, without work. The landscape decimated, changed radically. And yet, Amy, you say there are good things happening there after Katrina from which we might take lessons.
Yes, there are. And I think the best thing is that people understand that the need to build resilient communities is of utmost importance with the uncertainty that comes with climate change. So uncertainty is, what will these extreme weather events look like? When will they hit? How variable will our climate be over time? The best way to build is so we can absorb shock. You know, if we think about how wetlands function in ecosystems, they do just that. They absorb the shock of tidal surges, of hurricanes. How can we build our communities so that in time, as we're struck by these extreme events more frequently, we can absorb the shock of them? And so if there is an upside, if you will, or hopefulness, it is the opportunity to redesign our communities to be incredibly more resilient. And as Paul says, to include these other environmental issues that are pressing down upon us simultaneously.
So how do you redesign a community so that it's eco-friendly?
Yeah, well, in my book, I talk about Greensburg, Kansas, for instance, which was entirely wiped off the map a couple of years ago by a cyclone. Now, first, the caveat is some of these events we will not be able to adapt to. They will be too much. And there will be suffering, and there will be difficulty, absolutely. But there's also the opportunity to prepare and to build again with new design, as Greensburg did. They built with entirely ecologically designed. They built with a distributed power system. So as Paul says, it's a non-brittle power system. It comes from distributed solar and wind in the community so that buildings are creating more power than they consume. It comes with design features that are able to withstand high winds, whereas old housing designs did not. This is the opportunity to really think and have a shift in consciousness, really, an evolution. You know, I think I say in the book, when the car was introduced to New York City, people said there's no way it could go faster than 15 miles per hour. And why was that? Well, it would scare the horses. So if we think about what the future might be, it's that distinct from what in 1900 we thought transportation looked like.
But you know, Mike, I realize you're a scientist, you are not a psychologist, another branch. What is it that's affecting people, holding them back, having them cling to old ideas and believe they can stave off the future rather than be forced to adapt?
Well, I think you're right to identify that as the problem, that people are holding back. I think there is a fear of the future. Part of it's not knowing where to go. And to some extent, Amy's book and Paul's books try and say, we could have a better world if we are willing to make the transition. The trouble really is, though, the world is heading from 7 billion to 10 billion people, and there's tremendous momentum in the system. If you wait for the crisis, if we wait to see Greenland really melting, so it's happening rapidly as we think it could, and it lost roughly half its mass 125,000 years or so ago when it was not as warm as we're headed. Once that starts, it's not at all clear you can stop it. So you can talk about trying to help societies in some way or building a little better town, but we have a lot of coastal infrastructure. We have a lot of cities. There's a very interesting report by the National Natural Resources Defense Council about cities around the U.S. that are very vulnerable to sea level rise, and it's going to be very hard to protect them. So there's tremendous momentum. We have biodiversity loss. That's not something you can reverse once you have that kind of thing happen. So we really have to act before we get to a crisis, and that's a really hard thing to do.
Paul, do you feel that European governments are thinking ahead more than the U.S. government is in terms of climate change?
I think they are, but I think there are many other countries, and surprisingly, China is one of them, who are thinking ahead as well and doing more than my country, Australia, more than your country, the US, in terms of high-speed rail, in terms of tighter efficiency standards, in terms of stronger renewable programs and so on. So many countries now are getting ahead of both of our countries in terms of the economic opportunity here. And that, I think, is going to be a very big driver. There is, as Mike and Amy have said, a lot of suffering coming. Let's be clear, this is not all a good news story. Mm-hmm. The point is there's going to be a lot of damage done, but then there's going to be a response. And I think that we should recognise that that is an economic transformation, and therefore it's an opportunity for those countries that get in early. And what we're seeing so far is some countries in Europe, and interestingly, on the left and right of politics, so the conservative parties in Germany, France, the UK and so on, are actively advocating action on climate change, not from any kind of feel-good moral criteria, but because it's good for their economies to get ready for what's coming. And that, I think, is a really important point because, especially for the US, and I spend a lot of my life in the US, America has led on most of the great technological innovations and transformations we've seen in recent decades, and yet on this particular issue is currently missing in action as far as national policy goes. Now, we should acknowledge that there are some amazing things happening on the ground in terms of technology, in terms of venture capitalists investing in new ideas in this area, but I do think you need to have policy to drive that, and that's what we're seeing in China. We're seeing it in South Korea. We're seeing it in many parts of Europe. And we have to get that happening globally if we are to kind of leverage the great market opportunity in this change and recognise that we need to basically rebuild the economy and rebuild the way we run our societies to recognise that a low-carbon future is our only option. Paul, and when we move there, we have to move very fast.
Paul Gilding, he's climate change advisor, author of The Great Disruption, Why the Climate Crisis Will Bring on the End of Shopping and the Birth of a New World. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And joining us now is Mike Tidwell from the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Good morning to you, Mike.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. And I gather you'd like to talk about what's happening with the Chesapeake Bay.
Well, first of all, a great show. And I would just want to say that Paul Gilding's book, The Great Disruption, every American should read the book. It's just fantastic. And thanks for having a show about this issue. Climate change is not just, you know, something happening in Greenland and Antarctica. It's really the weather in the D.C. area, Washington, D.C., where I'm calling, is just unrecognizable in the last few years, and it's affecting the Chesapeake Bay. We see evidence of sea level rise, saltier water from sea level rise. It's just real, real impacts. And I'm wondering, my question for your panelists would be, do you think that the way that we talk about climate change in the United States, we tend to talk about it as a go green response, 10 ways you can go green at the office, 10 ways you can green your wedding, et cetera. And there seems to be a lot less emphasis on green laws and what laws our elected officials can pass. And if you look at great moral challenges in the past, and climate change is a great moral challenge, it's a question of right versus wrong because of all the suffering to innocent people that will happen. When you look at great moral challenges in the past, the civil rights movement, for example, we didn't ask bigoted Southern sheriffs and governors to consider 10 ways to go integrated every other Saturday per their convenience. The moral wrong was so great, we passed laws that ban the immoral practice. We need laws that begin to phase out coal and oil and talk about 10 laws that our lawmakers, 10 green laws that our lawmakers can pass. And I just think the emphasis, we do need adaptation. We need sustainable communities. But I don't think we're going to get there to scale. We might get little neighborhoods in New Orleans here and there. But to get to scale, we need to change the conversation from go green individually to real green statues.
All right.
I do not agree.
Thanks, Mike. Go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mike. Obviously, this has got to be and is increasingly framed as a moral issue. And if we think about the history of moral issues like these in America, we realize that a vocal minority in these social movements is what we need to tip the American public, not a majority, but a vocal minority. Let's just take slavery for a minute. You know, here was Jefferson espousing a breach with what was now immoral, an economy based on slavery. And yet it took time for him to truly and personally breach himself. That's the same kind of chronic complicity that individuals in America feel. They realize that the normative culture of fossil fuel use has got to be breached. It is rising the sea levels in the deltas of Bangladesh. It is responsible for these tremendous storms in large part that we're seeing. And so people are reaching for pragmatic efforts to make that breach real. And in time, it will follow with social policy and laws and litigation that will keep people within a moral code that is new and based on a new culture.
Mike.
When I came to Washington as a scientist, I was trying to understand partly why there were so many different views given all that we thought we understood about the science. And it's really that there's different perspectives that have to be reconciled. There's energy security, energy supply, and all of these kinds of things. And there are a few politicians who have been able to try and pull that together and create action. Governor Pataki was doing it. Governor Schwarzenegger has done it. So there are things that can be done to try and get us moving.
Mike McCracken, Chief Scientist for Climate Change Programs at the Climate Institute.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org, by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth on the web at aecf.org, and by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with terrorism expert Peter Bergen about the threat and influence of Al-Qaeda after the death of bin Laden. Bergen was one of the first Americans to interview bin Laden. His latest book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, just came out in paperback. He just returned from Pakistan. Join us.
And welcome back. It's time for us to open the phones as we talk about the possibilities of adapting to climate change. First to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Good morning. This has been an excellent discussion. I've been studying, following this for some years now. I'm not even sure where to begin. If you look at what some of the experts like Hansen and McKibbins say about not passing the 350 point on CO2, and some other scientists say that, well, really we can prevent the very worst of it if we don't go above 450 parts per million. You know, you look at the population that was just growth that a gentleman earlier mentioned, and the political factors that are going on. I think one of the reasons why this country can't really deal with this climate change issue the way it should is the power of the lobbyists, the coal, the Petroleum Institute, and the ability of them to hire a few scientists to present confusing facts and issues to the American public, and the media's effort to maintain a even balanced approach on information and data that really should not even be considered even and balanced, but they do so.
I don't think we have done that, Brian. I just want to inject that point. But you've raised already a great many things. I gather you also wanted to ask about technology that might be feasible to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to reverse climate change. Any such thinking going on, Mike McCracken?
Well, they're certainly thinking about it, and it would be desirable to do. But one way to do it is just to grow more forests, if you can use the land, because that will naturally pull carbon out of the atmosphere. If you want to do it as an industrial process, they're trying to do it to pull the CO2 out of the exhaust of power plants, where the CO2 is relatively concentrated, and that's turning out to be very expensive, or at least quite expensive. Hopefully they can figure out how to do it. But if you want to then just pull it out of the atmosphere, the concentration is so low that it's going to be a good bit more expensive than that. Right now, there's a lot of good options to go after that are much less expensive, which are efficiency is a tremendous thing to do. Prices of renewables are coming down. We can get off and do a great many things if we make a go of it.
Now, he also mentioned population growth, Amy, which is something great many of our listeners are sending in Facebook postings, messages about. How important is the question of population growth and climate change?
You know, population is a factor in every environmental issue that we face. But more important, actually, is the consumption of people who are already here. Really, if we look at the long-standing kind of algorithm of environmental impact equal to affluence, i.e. how much material goods a particular person or household has, times the population on the planet, times the technology, the efficiency, the way in which we can use energy more conservatively or more efficiently, that becomes the sum total of impact. Technology times affluence times population. And what we've seen is that affluence is a very, very strong factor, the stronger factor there than population yet. Now, if we had a population that wanted to live the way we live, for instance, we would need many, many more resources to do that. So as Paul points out in his book, perhaps, the idea is to live not only more efficiently, as Mike has been talking about, more conservatively,
but with less,
so that others can have more. And going back to, I think it was David's comment earlier, the caller, this is about a moral issue of growth and about materialism as well, because climate change is the sort of the first planetary constraint we're dealing with. Right behind it is fresh water. Right behind that is food security for those same numbers of people in the world. And so we need to think very holistically about the problem and not just proximally.
Paul, you might just talk about that.
Yeah, look, I'd love to, because I think this is really interesting. I'm pleased to hear Amy say that, because the numbers on this are very, very clear. So, for example, between now and 2050, the population is forecast to increase by about 35%. So that makes our problem 35% harder to deal with. In the same period of time, the per capita wealth is forecast to increase by 300%. So the issue of consumption isn't just a big issue, it is the overwhelming issue. And that's why I argue in my book that growth, the whole idea of endless economic growth or the concept of infinite growth on a finite planet, is simply an impossibility. And therefore, it's going to stop at some stage, and we need to manage that stopping. We need to plan for that and think about a different kind of economy built on happiness, built on quality of life, not going without and living in caves, but recognizing that we don't have to have more and more stuff to be more and more happy, and we can actually evolve to a higher consciousness in this process and recognize what really does matter to us as humans is not stuff, but community, you know, doing things with meaning, you know, pursuing happiness in a deeper way, not in a material way.
But, Paul, how optimistic are you that that kind of lifestyle, that kind of thinking, that kind of holistic approach can be realized?
Look, I'm optimistic that that will be our response to the crisis, but it won't happen before the crisis. So I'm realistic that humans don't respond prior to the crisis emerging, but then we're good. And so I think once we face the crisis, once we're, and this is not a pleasant crisis, let me be clear, we're not talking about an inconvenience. We're talking about global famine and disruption and weather disasters at a great scale with a lot of disruption, a lot of suffering going on. But once we face up to that reality, I do think we are going to see that we are capable of moving, you know, a sort of great leap forward, if you like, into a more holistic approach. Not because we're going to have this sort of moral awakening as much as we're going to have a necessity to change in order to survive as a species and to flourish. And necessity, you know, is a great driver of change.
Mike.
Well, I think it's important to understand. If you try and estimate, though, how much the natural world could support in terms of population, it's only a few hundred million. It's a few percent of what our world population is today. We're going to have to depend on technological kinds of contributions to make, to supply the food supply, the water, and the other things that we have. And we're going to have to draw energy from that in ways that don't further impact the planet. So I'm not quite sure what Paul's talking about in terms of collapse, but if you want to maintain a population like we have, it's going to require a tremendous amount of investment in engineering and technology to do that. Let me say one other thing, but to say how tough the problem is, though, because people talk about population. It's a lot about choices. If the entire developing world were not there and we're not using any fossil fuels, and the developed world of a billion and a quarter or so people continue on their present path, the temperature will continue to rise. The developed world's a major contribution to what's been causing the problem along the way. And we'll pass some of these warming thresholds that people were talking about. Jim Hansen talks about it. We're already past that, but the international leaders have talked about going over 2 degrees Celsius and getting dangerous above that. We'll pass that the latter part of the century just because of the choices that the developed world is making.
The developed world.
Yeah, we have to change our way. Now, certainly the developing world, if there were no developed world and they continue on the path they're on, the same thing will happen. We're all in this together.
But it
we have to make different choices.
It sounds from what you've said, Amy, that indeed the developing world may be making better choices now than the developed world
Absolutely.
Is making.
That's right. And there's a real opportunity, and we've seen this in the past, to leapfrog the kind of messy, now filthy approaches that the developed world has relied on, coal in particular, as they transition into an energy future that is actually renewable. So, for instance, right now, there are 2 billion unelectrified people in the world. We'll have another 2 billion people in the world who are presently don't exist, and so they will need electricity. How do we move that 4 billion people by mid-century to a renewable source of electricity? Well, in one hour, the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth's surface can fuel the world's economy for a year in 1 hour. So this superabundance of solar energy, not only photons of light energy, but the sun driving the hydrologic cycle, driving wind currents, and other kinds of current solar power is the way in which the developing world should be headed.
I was also talking about population and the choices that some in the developing world
making. Oh, yes, absolutely. And what we know, the strongest driver of population control in the developing world is the education of women. So important to make that clear. The more we have a literate, educated class of women, the fewer children they have. And in Bangladesh, even with not as much education as we'd like to see in women, they've moved from 6.5 children per family to 2.5 children per family in the last couple of decades.
All right. To Rochdale, Indiana. Good morning, Mary Ann. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate your voice in the dark. I'm calling from Indiana, and I guess I am a vocal minority because I'm speaking for the animals in confined animal feeding operations. But I would like to say that one big choice I feel that we all can make, knowing that these operations produce such gigantic carbon emissions, is to think about feeding, more talk about feeding our affluent society healthy with plant-based diet instead of focusing on our addiction to meat in this society.
Paul Gilding.
Yeah, very big issue, and one that's getting worse in terms of global environmental impact, because the wealthier people are becoming in China and India and so on, the more their diets are becoming like ours, so more meat intensive, more dairy intensive. And as the caller is correctly saying, this is causing very significant emission increases across the board, not just of CO2, deforestation and the like, but also methane emissions. So a very important issue. One in which the science is interesting and developing, I should say, that certainly the feedlot approach is certainly very damaging. There are some who argue, and the science on this is not yet clear, that certain types of grazing can actually help us to lock up carbon in the soil. So there is areas to work on here that we need to understand better in terms of the right approach, but there is no question that at the moment with current approaches that the consumption of meat as a major source of protein is increasing, and the emissions as a result of that are increasing. It is an important step that people can take.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. A caller in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for squeezing me in.
Sure.
Just in the last couple of weeks, I read an article in Forbes talking about how somebody had done some satellite or some analysis of satellite data from NASA, and they had found that the Earth isn't warming as quickly as some of the UN climate models had been modeling for, and that there may be some problems with the alarmists talking about how quickly the Earth's warming. I was just wondering if you're panel had heard anything about that, and if they had any comments on that article.
Mike.
I have heard it. It was it's sort of a scientific result getting published in a popular magazine. There have been a lot of problems that the scientific community has identified with that article. In general, the problem we face in trying to explain this to the public is that the media tends to focus right on the cutting edge. And at the cutting edge of science, there are always going to be things going back and forth and some disagreement, and they tend to like that. And they tend to forget and don't keep presenting and reminding everybody of the fundamentals of what's happening that make this problem real and something that's not going to go away. So you'll constantly hear little things at the edges coming up where there's disagreements. And it takes a while for scientists to sort of go through and pin those down.
Amy, I want to get to something that you've written in your book. You say you've already seen some of the reinvention taking place amongst insects and some animals.
That's right. So I start the book looking at these biological systems where we've been talking about response. Their response is evolutionary. So not only are animals and plants having to deal with these shifting conditions, they're actually changing their genetic structure. Natural selection is acting to favor particular traits that succeed, make them succeed in the environment.
Give me an example.
So one of the examples I've been talking about are these insects called pitcher plant mosquitoes, and they live at the base of these aquatic plants called pitcher plants. And these insects, for a long time, as long as people have studied them, enter their wintering hibernation at 15 hours of day length. But because the falls are so much warmer and so much more extended, they now enter their hibernation at 14 days. So the gene, what's actually been identified as the timeless gene, has been selected for those individuals that can actually take advantage of an extra hour of day length and many more weeks of reproduction and physiology and enter at a later date in the year.
Well, I would just comment that while populations change, the individual species, that means some are dying and some are surviving, new ones are coming up. The other thing that happens, though, that we're going to face is that pests and weeds tend to really love warmer temperatures and more CO2 and invasive species. And so there's going to be all kinds of things happening. Some are positive, and we'll see some indications that there can be some adjustments. But there's going to be a lot of changes happening that will make life very difficult.
Yeah, the importance of the model, absolutely, Mike is right that there are changes across ranges, across these different types of species. But the point I'm making is that the response was evolutionary, that we're seeing natural selection mediated by climate change that we have induced actually changing the genetics of populations. And that response is now evolutionarily, and we will respond through culture and evolution in time ourselves.
This is a conversation to be continued. Thank you all so much. It was fascinating. Amy Seidel, her book is titled Finding Higher Ground, Adaptation in the Age of Warming. Paul Gilding is climate change advisor. He's the author of The Great Disruption. And Mike McCracken is chief scientist for climate change programs at the Climate Institute. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.